one will get general air, if we can just hold it in a general area so that they can somewhat hear. Otherwise, if you've ever listened to the tapes in which I've had feedback, and I expect to have quite a bit today, there will be, it's just silent, and then I respond.
Sometimes.
It's rolling. Okay. If I can have your attention, we'll begin our post-convention evaluation. Let's begin with the prayer. Heavenly Father, you have given us your word, the means by which you reveal to us the truth about who you are and what you have done for us, and the truth about who we are and how you have forgiven our sins and made us children of God. Help us that we might cling to that word in spirit as well as in truth. In Jesus' name we pray.
Amen.
Okay, I've passed out for you white sheets that have has the president's report. It has some resolutions so that when I refer to them, I printed off some of them that you can take back and look at, and I might point you to them, but we obviously won't read from them. I've also given you a yellow or goldenrod sheet. The first two pages, front and back, simply go through and list all of the resolutions in number order. I got this off of the web. The Secretary of the Senate produced this, and I changed the columns just a little bit so that I could write some things beside it. This is about the best I can do, having been at convention all of last week and getting in Thursday night at 11, driving all day Friday and Saturday. Yesterday I worked to get this all put together. So it's pretty well an oral presentation to you. These things are to kind of jog my memory and to at least point you to them. Anything that I point to, though, whether it is a resolution, if it's not printed off, I can get to it for you, okay? Make a note, give it to me and say, Pastor, I'd like to see that document. Most of this also is online. At this particular point, though, what they do is they put together a daily, today's business every day, like Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. What will be listed there is not only some changes in some resolutions, but, for example, for Tuesday, they will have the minutes from Monday in it. Well, so I've got the minutes and I've got things up through Wednesday, but the last day of the convention was Thursday. Thursday's minutes and what actually happened on there, I am going by my scribblings and a couple other things, but the minutes aren't produced and it's not available online yet. And that's just because it probably took a couple days off before they put it together. So there's some things we don't have. We have well, I think, enough information in order to give you an evaluation of the convention. I expect, in fact, I'm going to ask, you know, that you ask me questions. We did a little bit, even while we were eating pizza, to talk about some of the things that have happened. Simply ask me about those. I am going to try to make sure that I go through and hit those resolutions that deal with our 6 points of dissent and make sure that you understand what the convention did or didn't do concerning those. Many of the other things, and there's a lot of things here that we could bring up, some of it may be interesting, some of it is not that important, but the reason I went down there is to hear the speeches, to see how things went. And I'm very glad that I went. And I think you'll find that as you ask me questions and I talk about things, you'll probably bring things to mind. And I have a lot of stories of people I talked to and those kind of things, which were, I'll just say, very helpful not only for me but for others. And I think as I give this presentation to you, I think it'll be helpful for you as well. Before I begin, first of all, in the June 2000 Trinity Trumpet, I gave a pre-evaluation of the Synodical Convention, in which what had already come out The convention workbook comes out. It has all of the overtures that the congregations have sent in. Okay? Our congregation sent in 10 overtures dealing with our 6 points. Of those 10 overtures, 2 of them were refused to be printed in the convention workbook. One of the conventions, I believe it was 2001, gave the synodical president the power to, if he thought that the overtures that were sent in were materially in error and or would open the Senate up to a slander lawsuit, that he did not have to print it in the convention workbook. This was a decision that he would make. 2 of our overtures, he deemed them to be materially in error. One of them was dealing with our 6th point of ecclesiastical dispute and resolution, in which we asked that the certain overture be overturned because the CCM had made an opinion that if your ecclesiastical supervisor says it's okay, then you wouldn't have to be tried. We put that in it. He responded by saying, your presupposition is materially in error because if the ecclesiastical supervisor did something that was wrong, he should admit it and change it. And therefore, for you to say that that's the way it's going to be, he said that was materially in error. He didn't print it. Which, what I will say is, that was our disagreement. Senate had his position, and we said, no, that's not what we believe that is. That's not what it says. And so he deemed it materially in error because we disagreed. The second overture that was not printed in the convention workbook was the one dealing with contemporary worship. Now, what's particularly interesting about this is this overture we took to the circuit forum. They passed it. We took it to the district. They modified it, watered it down a little bit, but they passed it 90% the same as what we did. The convention, Southern Illinois District Convention, printed our, what that we offered in their workbook, printed the one that was modified and changed and was passed by the district and convention by all of our congregations in the final proceedings of it. But when we sent it into the synodical president, he said it's materially in error, we can't even print it. But it worked fine for our district. He sent it back. Why did he say it was materially in error? He said that by our overture, we cast aspersions upon those who were doing contemporary worship and questioned whether they were being faithful. Yes, yeah. That was our point.
Yes.
He cited Isaiah 55, in which it said, the word will go out, it will not return to me void, but will accomplish the purpose for which it sent it. And he said, our overture, by denying contemporary worship, we are denying that God's word will do what it says. He didn't print them. He sent it back to us with this. I will give credit to our synodical our district president, Herbert Miller, who, when he received back the one from the Southern Illinois District that they couldn't print it, he modified it even more, took out the parts that President Kieschnick said were material in error. He had the board of directors of the Southern Illinois District approve it, send it back into convention, and it did appear as a late overture in this today's business, the first today's business, which had the floor committees, what the floor committee has already approved. So it was after the floor committee approved that it actually comes out, but it is listed in here, okay? So at least someone got to see at least 85% of our work or something like that. That's the 2. The other 8 were printed in the convention workbook. Some were not correct. I did send a letter, and I did get word back that they printed some corrections, and those did come later. They, however, I did not realize that if they thought that 2 overtures were somewhat similar, they would not print them both, but they would simply stick your name under the overture that came in first. So where we had an overture and said, we want this to happen, we want this rescinded and done, when the Southern Illinois District, we sent that overture into them, when they approved it and said, well, we don't want to rescind, but we want to encourage something or another. So when it came printed in here, our name got stuck underneath the one that the Southern Illinois District passed because theirs was sent in first. Well, of course, it was in February 2006 when the district convention was. And I said, that's not our overture with our name. Well, this is normal procedure, I was told. Okay, I did get a nice letter from Secretary Hartwig. I sent it out to the synodical president, to the floor committee chairman of number 3. I sent it to Secretary Hartwig. I asked President Miller about it because I sent him a copy, and he said, I doubt you'll get any response at all. Secretary Hartwig sent me a response in 3 days, and it was a 2-page response, and he actually went through and said, the ones that Kieschnick didn't print, that's his prerogative. The ones that we did this, this is common procedure, and this is what, you know, this is the way we do it. And he even went on to say, in 2 of those instances, you're absolutely right. It probably would have been better to print yours instead of grouping your name under someone else. I went, wow, I haven't had anybody admit wronghood, falsehood, and I don't know how long. I was kind of surprised. Okay, our overtures were printed in there. They're all print. All the congregations over there are printed. They come out in this floor committee. The floor committee takes all these overtures. Each committee, there's 8 of them. They take maybe 100 overtures. They bring them down to probably 10 or someone in that area, and they propose 10. The floor committees, most of the time, they take what's been given them, and they kind of take 2 or 3 and put them together and do some things. But just to let you know, the floor committees can do anything they want. They can take those 100 overtures that the congregation send in, throw them aside, write their own resolution, and propose it. That is legal. Now, it may not be quite ethical. Normally, you take what the congregations are concerned about and respond to it. There are many different times in which 5 to 10 congregations and or groups said, this is important to us. It never shows up in a floor committee resolution. Or if it does show up, and you're going to hear me talk about this, it's not the exact same concern. Okay? What am I finally going to get to? And I'll get to those individuals. I produce this saying, here's what the floor committee's proposed. I don't know if it's going to be approved or not, but here's what they proposed. And normally, the things that they propose get passed. So I wrote up this pre-convention, pre-evaluation of the 2007 Synodical Convention. The short answer to our meeting today is mark out the word pre. Put the word post. That's what happened. What I said was going to happen in this thing is what happened. Of all the overtures that were proposed, 1 failed. Every other one passed or was amended and passed. Some didn't. Obviously, they ran out of time, but that's what happened with it. Far-reaching, overarching issue. 2 things I want to just quickly deal with: elections, and I want to deal with something that I would say is kind of what I will say the overarching bridge of the convention, is this. If any of you got the Lutheran Witness for June, July of 2007, in it, it had the 5 people that were up for synodical president and asked them questions concerning it. When it comes to elections in Missouri, the elections for president, first vice president, are full-time positions. Election for 2nd through 5th vice presidents are not full-time positions. Of those elections, at least from my perspective, having been to several conventions, those elections are mainly based on knowledge. I know that Wallace Schultz was on the Lutheran Hour, and I remember him from this, and I know his guy was elected, and I see his picture and whatever. It's mainly people know these people. And this presents it in a way in which people read through it, and for example, I went to one of our shut-ins, and he said, yeah, I read through that. You know, which one of those do you like? And you know, I mean, he could cite me what they said on here. And I was like, wow. But that's what I'm pretty sure people do, because some people said, what happened with this election? You got Kieschnick elected, reelected. Then you've got pretty well all the vice presidents are the Jesus First and Kieschnick team, except for John Woolrobbie, who was running against President Kieschnick, gets a 2nd vice president position. How did this happen? And I would say, you know, I've seen it happen before. Back in 2001, Kieschnick was elected, and then the guy that was running against him, Daniel Preuss, was elected 1st vice president. I mean, it sounds ridiculous if you're thinking, you know, 2 people running for president of the United States, and, you know, us putting one as one and one as vice president, you know, but it's not unusual with the beginning. Why? Because they vote on, I know that guy's name. I like him. You know, and maybe he didn't get president, but let's put him here. Most people don't use the voter guides that come out, the Jesus First Voter Guide, the United List Voter Guides, when it comes to the first ones. And that's the way I would characterize this. President Kishinev was reelected with a 53% vote. It may not sound like he squeaked through. Actually, that's a pretty good margin. I would have thought it would have been maybe 55, but all right, he was reelected by a pretty good number. The other elections that follow after, all the other ones that go through with it, I'm going to say most people don't know. Now, there's, you know, secretary, mayor, financial treasurer, but after that, you're left. You got to vote for 100 people. They're on a list. They call it the big ballot. This is the big ballot. They take 45 minutes, and they sit down, and, you know, all the other ones, they vote, you know, right on there, and they puts up on the screen, they push a button. These, they vote, and then you find out the next day. People have to use a voter's guide. There is no way that you're going to know any of them. I mean, even if you would take time, they put like a little paragraph and they tell you who they are, but about the only ones that you're going to know are LWML past presidents. And I can tell you, anyone that's an LWML past president immediately elected, okay? Everybody knows, you know, who these are. This is an example of the documents that were put out by Jesus First, pretty fancy, full color kind of things. This was put out on Thursday. It has a list of everybody that was elected on the back, except for, I think, two instances. Everyone is from the Jesus First list. There were no conservatives elected except for like two exceptions. One of those exceptions, I'll mention a little bit later, happens to be from a congregation whose pastor I talked to and who said, we are leaving the synod after this convention. If I go back and go on my knees and beg my elders to stay, he said, I don't think they'll listen to me. So that one that we actually got, in 6 months he'll be ineligible to serve. So we really only have one. And then John Woolrabi. That's elections. Overarching theme. I thought it was said very well in here, and if you take a look at it, there is a big difference. What, in your opinion, is the most pressing issue facing the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? President Kishinev says we need to have a renewed focus on...
Missions.
Bingo. Ask the next guys. Woolrabi, our Synod is divided over doctrine and practice. Schultz, the church has struggled. We need to remove discord and division. He talks about doctrine and practice. Diekelman, Kishinev's first vice president, goes back to missions. We need to have passionate leadership to do missions. Preuss says that the greatest challenge is retaining our identity. We seem to be more divided in our doctrine and practice than we ever have been. You would begin to go, aha, I can see this kind of doctrine and practice thing being the conservatives. What would we say? We would say, yeah, what's going on? We have a division in doctrine. We don't believe the same things, therefore it's coming out in our practice, right? If you believe the truth, you would have closed communion. If you don't believe, you can believe anything you want, you would have open communion or practice. So we would say, yeah, there's a problem in doctrine and practice. Second question, ask President Kishinev, or asked all of them, what other issues need to be addressed? Listen, Kishinev's answer, integration of doctrine and practice. You go, hey, wait a minute, can he use those words? I thought we could only use them. No, he can use them. And he does a very good job of it. Listen to what he says. Integration of doctrine and practice. Acknowledging our doctrinal solidarity while addressing any disagreements we have over how to put doctrine into practice. In a culturally largely indifferent or hostile towards Christianity, in a culture that's largely indifferent or hostile towards Christianity, what am I getting at? The convention, and again, in overtures and resolutions, in presentations from the floor, it was said from the podium again and again, we are not divided over doctrine. We have unity in this church. The problem in the present administration's eyes is that we just disagree over how to put things into practice. So we all agree there ought to be closed communion. It's just some people practice it a little bit differently. Some people practice closed communion, like, openly. Well, they would liken this to dividing or disagreeing over things that don't matter. These are just ways in which we practice it, but we all agree. And so, when a Trinity Lutheran Church in Heron, Illinois says, we're not going to commune with those who teach differently, who practice contemporary worship, who do da-da-da-da-da-da, what happens? They look at us and say, oh no, you can't divide over that, because that's relatively unimportant. Those are just practice. We say, no, we're divided on doctrine. Kieschnick says, no, it's just, we're united on doctrine, it's just how we practice it. And so all of the overtures, resolutions that come forward, they never ask the question, and let me, I guess, give an example. We talk about closed communion, and congregations are practicing open communion. That resolution would not come up, but a resolution did come up, and it is on page 2 of your goldenrod sheet, the back of the first page. You'll notice that the overtures are listed on the left-hand side, 302, 303, 304, whatever. Then I put a little number in a circle. That's the ones I'm going to refer to. Those are our 6 points to kind of keep us going. Take a look at number 1, 309 and 313. Both of them have a 1 by it. Our overture, in which we said the district presidents ought to go and visit their congregation, find out who's doing closed and who's doing open communion, and deal with those who are doing open communion. 313, to respectfully decline overtures. Our overture was included in there, and what they said was, this is already in the Constitution for district presidents to do this, therefore you don't really need a resolution for it. Why did we put it in there?
Because they're not
doing it. But exactly. So it was declined. This overture passed with an 84.6%. You do have an overture, though, 309, to address the administration of the Lord's Supper, in which they say, we're going to ask the CTCR, because of there's been a lot of concerns on how we practice this, we're going to ask them to prepare practical guidelines on how to practice closed communion in a multicultural environment mm-hmm. in which there are exceptions, in which... So that comes before the convention. This happened again and again. We said, we want you to reject this. And they said, well, how can we practice this and make this work? We said, serial prayer, same page, go up to 305, page 2, 305, you see 3 and 3. We said, serial prayer, the idea that because one guy follows another, and they do it in a series rather than all speaking at the same time, it's okay and it's not unionism or syncretism. We said that's utterly ridiculous. That's the problem. That is syncretism. They brought a resolution forward, not to say is it right or is it wrong, but let's ask the CTCR to prepare guidelines for us how we can do serial prayer in civic events. If you read my blog, how did I describe this? And I give you all of it on the last 2 pages of this. I described this like a plane. And I said, the synodical plane, we already have left the runway, we already have a destination in mind, and here's where we're going. Now, if someone like ourselves, like we, get up and say, wait a minute, we don't like where you're going. We think something's wrong here, we want to change it. There were no resolutions to change it. We are going to this destination and that's it. We were asked, well, would you like to fly lower or higher to where we're already going? Well, if I gave you a packet of peanuts, would that make you happy? No, I don't like where we're going. Tough. The plane's left, and we've got a flight plan, and this is where we're going, and that's what the convention did. It went somewhere, and it did not veer from it. Now, that brings a lot of problems to delegates that are concerned, because what? Something is brought up to the delegates, and what do they bring up to them? Not the thing that they want to discuss, but they bring up to them this secondary kind of issue. So what do you do when someone says, let's discuss whether we ought to have practical guidelines on how to use serial prayer? You can't have that discussion. Another analogy that I use to explain this. If your 10-year-old son says he wants to have a birthday party and he would like alcohol served at this birthday party, you as a parent say, absolutely not. You know, he says yes, you say no. If you then debate the resolution that says, let's debate what kind of alcohol we should serve at your 10-year-old's party, you'll never get to the bottom of this issue. That's the kind of thing that we were continually presented with. So what? If you're a delegate and you vote it down, have you really done anything? Well, no, because we never really... As far as we know, you can still do whatever. That was the real problem with this. Now, I will say, and as we go on to some other resolutions, I will say that, to their credit, there were delegates, good delegates. Paul Weber of Anna was one of them, who would get up, and when that came to the floor, stated, I'm going to say the elephant in the room, serial prayer is wrong. You should, you know, and stated that, and the delegates kind of went, next. Or President Kishnick used a parliamentary kind of rules that allowed things to happen that just technically weren't wrong, but it's not the way you do it, okay? And let me explain that. The president gets up to, he runs the meeting, synodical president, okay? He calls on who needs to be called on. How does this work? Well, the floor committee comes up, they read the overture, the resolution, and they say, we move adoption. The president then takes from the floor pros and cons so that there is a debate and runs the meeting, and when they call for a vote, he does that. That would be quite fair. If there are questions where a delegate would come to the mic and say, I don't understand what this says, normally you would ask the floor committee to elaborate. What does this mean in the fourth whereas when it says this? Well, let's ask the committee, and the committee would speak, and so they're standing up there for that. But normally that's the only time. Not in this convention. In this convention, we're going to talk about, you know, a serial prayer, right? As soon as someone says, serial prayer is wrong, whatever, President Kishnick says, would the floor committee like to respond? And so then the floor committee would say, well, this is, you know, we've already approved this and everything is fine. Everyone agrees that this is the way it is and the CTCR already had a document on it. So then President Kishnick calls on someone pro who says, I really like this overture, okay? And then the next person, con, says, wait a minute, we got problems with this. And then President Kishnick says, would the floor committee like to respond? So at every point, if there's something negative, you go to the floor committee and you have them rebut what's said. The delegates have 2 minutes. Floor committee, they can talk as long as they want. He did this with the floor committee chairmen all the time. He did this with the CCM chairman. If he didn't like what was there, then you ask the CCM, well, do you think this is going according to the bylaws of the thing, Constitution? Or you ask the parliamentarian, so you got like 4 people you can talk to. And I thought, you know, could this be any less fair? Yeah, guess what happened? Day 3, they brought the resolution for lay ministers forward, okay? The lay minister one is on 502, page 3, to address lay deacons, 502. The one dealing with lay ministers, what did it say? It said, we need to study this issue for another 3 years to see if there's still a need for lay ministers, and then we'll bring a report back to the convention at the end. Well, guess what? Not only to Committee 5, but Committee 3, if you go to the second page, Resolution 312, produced the exact same resolution as Committee 5 did. Word for word. There was only one word change, one difference. It was the exact same one. One came out of Committee 3, one came out of Committee 5. So do you know what he decided? Well, we ought to have both committee chair people come up front. So anytime someone said something against lay ministry, would the committee like to respond? And would the other committee like to respond? Wow, we had like 2 people rebut everything negative said. So it wasn't quite fair, but at least things were said from the convention floor. Once again, this overarching theme, and then we'll go to was, we are united in doctrine, we're not united in practice. Our congregation has said these are doctrinal issues. Senate is heterodox. You don't commune with false teaching. The Senate and Convention said, we're united in doctrine. It's just practice. And since we all have the same doctrine, you can't divide. If you divide, you're schismatic. We were declared schismatics, that is, people who divide over things that don't matter. That's our problem. Okay? That's what you were labeled. Your problem is you don't care enough about mission because you're too concerned about all these other things. So that's kind of the overarching, that's my introduction. Yep.
I had a question. A lot of our members may feel that the only problems that we have or the Senate has is our 6 points on our State of Confession. Resolution 304A, to call for a study of the natural knowledge of God. Could you touch on that briefly, where that's coming from and where it's likely to lead?
Yes, if you turn, I think I gave you this one. I don't know if I did or not, to tell you the truth. Let's see if it's in here. 304, yeah, page 72. It's about the fifth page on down after the president's report. There were two overtures that dealt with our point dealing with syncretism and unionism. That is 304A and 305. This one here that has, it just has 304, is not 304A, but it'll give you a feel for what we're looking at, and I'll explain. What is the deal with 304? The natural knowledge of God is this. According to the scriptures, things are revealed to us.
You have 304A on the last page, 184.
Thank you. Go to page 184. Yeah, last page, inside part, 304A. According to natural knowledge of God, we would say, what can someone know if they don't have the revealed knowledge of God's word? We would say they can know two things. They can know, one, that God exists simply by creation, seeing what has been made and say there has to be a God. These things don't come about just by chance. Two, this God is powerful. He is great. But other than that, that's all you can know from a natural knowledge of God. You can know that there is a God, and you can know that he is powerful and he demands certain things. That is, your natural knowledge of the law. He demands right and wrong. There are certain things that just go against conscience. You can't go and kill someone or steal from somebody. It's just inalienable rights. We know that. That's all we can know. What do they say, the other side? They say that natural knowledge of God is that someone, though they would say that they are not saved, and take a look at lines 23, 24, 25, resolved that the Senate and Convention reaffirm its confession that there is no salvation apart from Jesus Christ, and that it is impossible to worship the one true God in spirit and truth, John 4, 23 and following, apart from saving faith in Jesus Christ. That resolve sounds really good. What does it say? There's no salvation apart from Jesus, and we say, yeah, it's what we've been saying, right? They would say, yes, but Muslims, Jews, can still worship the one true God, though they're not saved, they could still worship him, but not in the right way. They would say they can worship him improperly. The floor committee resolution said worship him improperly. And I wrote in here, I said you could drive a Mack truck through that because that's wrong, that they could still worship. You can't worship the true God unless you know who he is. And they can't know. They can know there is a God. So what did they change it to? They changed it from improperly on page 24, or line 24, to in spirit and truth, John 4, 23 and following. Now that's the exact same thing. There is no change in the meaning of that. What are they saying? Jews can worship, not in spirit and truth, but they can worship God. So they changed the wording, but it means the exact same thing. The convention saw that. Someone got up to the mic and said, listen, you didn't meet our concern. we don't believe this is true. Let's make it very clear. Just mark out the words, in spirit and truth, John 4, 23 and following. Just mark those words out. And what would it say? It's impossible to worship the one true God, apart from saving faith. That would make it very clear. This is ambiguous. It kind of draws the line. It's ambiguous. The delegates voted that amendment down. They like this. In fact, someone got up tonight. Now, John 4 is the one where Jesus is talking to the Canaanite, or the Samaritan woman at the well, right? Someone got up and in response to this amendment that was proposed and didn't pass, someone got up and said, I like this reference to John 4 because it talks about the woman at the well and she was worshiping the one true God and yet she wasn't and said this is a perfect example. So, were there things done that weren't right? Yes. Did the delegates understand everything? No. But when it was pointed out, they always chose the wrong one. Intentionally. I mean, someone got up and actually said it. So how does a banking and others want to use this? Well, we can go and have civic events with them, and we can all worship. They'll worship improperly. I'll worship properly. But this can be in a way of beginning evangelism. And so they turned it into mission. That's what they're saying by that.
So you can't accuse them of idolatry.
No, you can't accuse them of idolatry. And you can't accuse them of saying there's a way to God apart from saving faith. But this is the way you get around unionism, syncretism.
It's the same thing that goes on in the Old Testament. I wish they'd read it.
Perfect, Tony.
Someone tried to substitute another scripture verse in place of this that actually it was even clearer, and they wouldn't have that either. What about the other one? I already mentioned 305, in which they said, how are we going to do serial prayer? What would be a good way to do this? In both of these instances, and you'll notice on the right side on this page, with 304A and 305, I put a couple things. That amendment that tried to take those words out failed by a 64% vote. Continually from the front, and maybe you've heard me say this before, I think the biggest problem with the Missouri Synod right now is that we have been taught to trust the Missouri Synod. Whenever I got up and said what Kieschnick and Behnke did was wrong, people said, well, how can you say that? Well, I'm praying for their repentance. Well, you can't do that until the Synod speaks on this. Why not? It's in the Scriptures. It's wrong. Until the Synod and Convention talk, I mean, you can't. We put our faith, in the Missouri Synod. Again and again, here's another example. Executive Director of the CTSR, Sam Nasker, will you come up? And he gets up and he cites the Augsburg Confession, and President Kieschnick then from the podium says, we have talked about this, and the seminary presidents and I agree, and the council of presidents, we all agree, and the board of directors, we've talked with them, and they agree. And continually assure them that the authorities that be understand this, and we accept it. You don't need to know the particulars or why or whether this agrees. Just somebody up here at the podium agrees. I mean, it was the authority figures. When people from the floor said things that disagreed from the authority figures, that's how I know this. Go to number one. Committee number one. Go to... where's the fellowship with the ALC? Is that three? Sorry about that. Three, bottom of the first page. There it is. 301. To declare altar and pulpit fellowship with the American Association of Lutheran Churches. What happened? It was brought up, the AALC, we want to have fellowship with them. They brought the Sam Nasker up. He said, we have talked with them. We've been having meetings. We agree in doctrine and practice. There were some issues, but we have worked all of those out. And the CTCR, the commission, we all agree that we ought to go and altar and pulpit fellowship with them. Everything's taken care of. The delegates got up. One delegate got up and said, I have an AALC congregation in my town, and they have a non-Lutheran pastor. Someone else got up and said, I did a survey and called around and asked them about open communion and charismatic activity, and many of them did those very things. Someone else, there was a third one. This is the only time a district president got up and actually contradicted what was said from the floor. Okay? The Central Illinois district president got up and said, I have removed from the roster Missouri Synod Lutheran pastors for, you got to do a lot to get removed from the Missouri Synod, right? Okay? Remove them from the Missouri Synod, and now the AALC has welcomed them into membership without ever talking with me, without ever working this out, and as soon as we approve this, they will now be able to come back into the Missouri Synod and serve an altar and pulpit fellowship. And as far as I know, there are six or seven men, at least that we know of right now, who were kicked out of the Missouri Synod and are members of the AALC. And Sam Nasker rebutted, and the district president got up again and said, no, I want you to answer this question about this, you know, that this hasn't been dealt with. Sam Nasker says, it's all been dealt with. The delegates say, I've got examples where it hasn't been. 301, passed, 71%. Now, I mean, there's only two, I said in my blog, there's only two ways to understand this. Either one, we only believe the authority figures, and the people that are down, the delegates on the floor, they must not know. We just don't believe them. Or two, we know there are problems, but we don't care. I don't know any other way of responding to that. Page one. Let's take a look at contemporary worship. If you go in your white sheets, we need to get to 201 and 202. 201 is page 61. This overture passed with a 76.3% of the vote. It says to foster greater unity of worship through theological conferences. It's about the, fourth or fifth page in the middle of this. Says district and congregational services at the top. Resolution 201. It has a lot of whereases, but when it finally gets down to line 23, whereas previous conventions of the Senate have addressed the diverse viewpoints in our church body concerning worship, yet tension remains in our walk together. Resolved that the Commission on Worship, CCR, organize a model theological conference including representatives and pastors and laity from each district, as well as representation from each of our schools of higher learning, in order to, quote, build greater understanding of our theology of worship and foster further discussion of worship practices that are consistent with that theology. I'm sure that there were delegates that thought that this was pretty good. What are we going to do? We're going to talk about the problems. We're going to talk about worship, and we're going to come to a greater understanding. We're going to make sure that it agrees with our doctrine. And there probably were some that voted for it because of that particular instance that it said here. That's not exactly what it says, and that's not exactly what it means. When it talks about this diverse viewpoints, diverse worship, I brought up to you that the 2004 convention produced a resolution in which they encouraged diverse worship. And I said, that is code language for contemporary worship. When I went outside our congregation and talked about it, some people said, oh, you're reading into that. Yeah, oh, you're just, you know, you're not putting the best construction on everything. It hit big time. Now, here, this passed. So you say, aha, well, at least we're going to discuss it, right? Now, go to 202A. I think it's towards the back, second to last page. Resolution 202A. This was the second resolution that was passed by Committee 2. What does this one say? Well, it says that first line, beginning at line 10, whereas many LCMS congregations are regularly making use of contemporary worship songs to the glory of God and the edification of his people, has a lot of other whereases that talk about this. But when you get down to 25, Whereas the 2004 Convention of the Synod directed the Commission to initiate a process leading toward the development of diverse worship resources. That's the one I showed you. Therefore, be it resolved. Now, here's the resolved. That the Commission on Worship implement the recommendations included in its report to the Convention, CW page 54.
But you knew that was going to happen when you read the first one.
Well, here, check this out. When you, it's all printed out, right? But when you get up to the mic, they've pretty well said, oh, we're not going to read all that. We'll just read the resolution. So they say, Resolution 202A, that Commission of Worship implement the recommendations included in its report to the convention, CW page 54. All right, now let's have discussion on this. Convention workbook. Not the floor committees, not the stuff that they passed all the time. This book, which is an inch thick, that had all those overtures that, you know, were left behind. I flew out of Minneapolis. Did I take this book with me? Why? I can't pack it. It's too much. How many people before them at the convention had this book in front of them? They have no idea. We're going to implement the recommendations. They don't have a clue what this is, right? Turn the page. Back of that page, I copied out for you what the convention workbook actually had. This is the appendix to the Commission on Worship, page 54. Go to the right-hand column, 204 Subcommittee, Report on Diverse Worship. They have recommendations. Let me walk through them for you. Recommendation number one, concerning Commission on Worship, we're going to have publication, web distribution of quarterly magazines, resource packets, worship planning, modeling, new songs, utilization of new media technology, teaching new music. Two, we're going to offer worship arts and music seminars and conferences. Two, do more diverse contemporary worship. Three, we're going to do web-based lists of appropriate accessible lists of pastors and worship leader positions so that more people can find out who's doing it and get around. Number three, we're going to talk to the seminaries and have them to develop curriculum in order to train future pastors to do diverse worship and model this on the campus of the seminaries. Five, we're going to ask the Board for University Education to develop a worship degree in contemporary worship in music and arts. Six, we're going to develop a composers group that they might network together and be able to offer these materials for others. If there is anything that the person in the pew is going to see over the next 3 years in the Missouri Senate, I mean, the person in the pew, they may not see all this other. The Commission on Worship was filled with pretty good guys elected by, appointed by Dr. Barry. They were putting together a hymnal. The hymnal came out, Lutheran Service Book. Very good hymnal, okay? Pretty good hymnal. Came out with this hymnal. Now that the hymnal's produced, Kieschnick came in. He tried to get a whole lot of diverse worship in there, couldn't do it. I mean, they threw a couple bones to him. But other than that, it ended up being a good hymnal. It's done. It's produced. It's out. The guys on the Commission on Worship, they're all hired, have now started to leave. The executive director has gone to Fort Wayne. Others going back to the parish. Guess what? Kieschnick now is going to appoint all new members to the Commission on Worship. And since the hymn book's gone, what's going to come out for the next 3 years? Contemporary worship extravaganza. We left the back door open with the Lutheran Service Book. We produced an electronic edition in which your congregation can sign up for this. It's connected to the internet, and when you're planning your service, you look at this and say, oh, I don't want the Gloria in Excelsis or that stinking introit. I'm going to get a Twyla Paris song. So you click on here, and it pops up on your screen. And don't worry, you're connected to the internet, it'll go to CPH, and they will send you a bill at the end of the month for each contemporary worship music that you get. And it's going to be pretty easy, no more cut and pasting, no more getting copyrights. I mean, you can do this quick. Right now, there's not many things on that. And it's pretty good. In the next 3 years, it's going to be wide open. Wide open ballgame. What did I mention about this one on my blog? I mentioned that some guys got up and concerning Resolution 202A and said, should we really pass 202A? We just said we were going to study it. How do we know it's good? Now you're saying that we're going to go full bore and do this, but we haven't yet studied it yet. They passed it. Oh, you know what they said from the floor? We don't have disagreement in doctrine. We're united.
Just
It's not. We just need to build an awareness of our practices in worship and that they're all okay. We didn't say in 201 that we were going to see whether it was right or not. We said we're going to take those stuffy congregations and teach them how this is okay. They didn't say that, but that's what they meant. All right, that is, let's see, worship. We got that one done. Association, AALC, we got that one done. Turn the page. I dealt with the study of natural knowledge, matter of serial prayer. 307, this probably was the one that said the least. It simply said, the CTCR already is planning on putting out a document in 2009, or 2008, I can't remember. Maybe it was 2008. I think it was 2009. Putting out a document already that's going to answer all your questions concerning the service of women. So, all of you that wrote in overture saying that we didn't apply the order of creation, that you didn't like what we did and whatever, we've got a new document that's coming out, and we have all, it involves four consultations. We've talked to 8 men and 8 women, and we've brought them together again and again to get their opinion, and we're writing this document on what the relationship between men and women. We didn't like the first CTCR document. I don't know how the CTCR is going to come out with a new one that's going to help. And I would think that they would want to study Scripture instead of asking the opinions of 8 men and 8 women. I mean, I don't care if you're a man or a woman. If you go to God's Word, it ought to say the same thing. It doesn't matter what gender you are. That's not what's going on. And there were some amendments that were proposed. One was actually accepted. It kind of helped, but once again, it didn't say that what the last document was wrong. In fact, it said, we want to commend what the CTCR responded to expressions of dissent concerning women, which they said it's all okay, the stuff that Trinity Heron sent in and said it was wrong. It's not wrong. And they commended the Senate to study that some more. That one wasn't answered either.
Well, that was just put off in our walk for missions, where the big thing is contemporary worship. I'm not going to push the woman button until we're going to get through this contemporary worship. However, in 3 or 4 or 5 years, we're going to talk about women.
Right.
We're not going to talk about all these at the same time.
At the same time? No.
Certainly not.
Mm-mm. Correct.
We're not going to ban guns all at once. We're just going to get the automatic first.
Correct.
Tell them what you said about women's ordination is the one thing.
When I talk with guys about, and they're concerned about what's going on in Senate and whatever, you can hear them say, many of them will say something like, yeah, well, this and that, you know, and you talk about, well, this is a problem, and why aren't you leaving? Well, when they do, then I'll leave.
And it's when they ordain women.
There is never anything else put in that box. When I stop there, they don't. Nothing else is there, and I find that interesting. Now, let me give you another story, and it's really fascinating. I'm flying home. I'm flying to Minneapolis. When I'm in Denver, I'm waiting in the airport. I got a couple hours left. I'm sitting and I'm reading, and they say, "Now we moved your gate." So I pick up my stuff, and as I'm walking over, this guy comes by. And he's got a black shirt on. Is the white part of the collar he's taken off and put away. So I'm kind of like trying to figure out, is this guy a pastor or not, you know? And he says, well, what are you reading? And the Ecclesiastical History of Socrates Scholasticus. You know, I mean, you just don't say that to anybody, right? You know, because I'm going, well, we'll see if he's a pastor, you know? You know, to which he says, you know, oh, I haven't read that one. I got that serious. And I'm going, okay, I think I know, you know. Okay, so as we move over, we sit down beside each other, and we start talking, and, you know, he's a pastor, Missouri Senate pastor, who has been at the convention. I lost my train of thought. And so we start talking about some things that went on, and laughing about some things, and he appears to be a very conservative pastor, you know, and agrees with me. So we're talking about this. And at one point he says, well, yeah, you know, and these things are growing wrong, you know, and we really got to, like, stick together and do something. You know, we just got to stop these guys from leaving the Senate, because then they can't help us in this fight.
Hello.
I said, well, I'm leaving in August. Oh. So we begin to talk, you know. After I talk with him for just a little bit, even before that happened, finally I go, who are you? You know, and he told me his name, and it was instant name recognition. I knew it was, but I just didn't recognize the guy. Oh, I'm sorry, you know. So then we talk about this, and then he says this, and I say, well, we're, you know, well, what's wrong? And I go, well, you know, and I start to explain to him a couple things, and I mentioned, well, our congregation has, you know, 6 points or whatever. And he stops, and he looks over, and he goes, well, where are you? I go, well, I'm down in Southern Illinois, Trinity Heron. He goes, no, what's your name? Michael Henson. He goes, I read your stuff. You got good stuff. What? You know, yeah, I used your stuff. Our 6 points, you know. Well, yeah. And so we start talking a little bit more, and none of these things. Where I was getting at was, when I talked about Whiteman's ordination is the only thing, we start talking about this, and he says, but you know, in the 70s, we had where they denied the scriptures and the people could really rally behind that. But there's really nothing for the people that they can rally by. I mean, you're right in all those 6 points, but there's nothing that's like just really, you know, important that the people can just rally behind. And I think he's right. Most people fell into it. Most people don't see those things as that important. So I said, but this is an issue of public confession. I go, and if the Senate is heterodox, and I said, you're a member, you know, he goes, well, where are you going to go? I go, I don't have to go anywhere. I'm a Lutheran. You got Word and Sacrament Ministry. You know, you're called a pastor. I said, you don't have to go. You don't have to run to Rome or Eastern Orthodox. I said, Senate is a human organization. I'm church. Wherever the Word and Sacraments are rightly ministers, it's church. And so I don't have to go anywhere. I said, but you flee falsehood because it goes against your public confession. At this point, he began to tell me, he began to apologize to me. I got like a 1,400 member congregation. I got a school. I got 10 teachers on. I mean, there's really no way I could leave Senate. I mean, I I'd really like to do something. I'd really like, I mean, it went from, these guys, I hope they don't leave, to now he's apologizing. Well, man, I wish I could leave. You know, and I really, there's reasons why I can't. You know, and I said, you know, and so we talked about the problem with the conservative group. You know, consensus was like moving it forward. We had a meeting in Chicago we went up to and talked about it, and everyone was going to do something. And then all of a sudden it all ground to a halt. You know, we're not doing anything. And I said, the guys that were doing that all had an issue. They either were on a seminary campus, in which if you leave the Missouri Synod, you no longer have a job. They were had aspirations to be there. They were being paid by the district because they were campus ministry or prison ministry or whatever. They had aspirations to move up. As soon as you begin to look at all this, you kind of go, well, if we like say something's wrong and then we hold it out, and then, well, then we'd have to do something. And we're not going to do nothing. And I said, so they held back. And I said, now nobody is there to lead. And I said, so our congregation pretty well did the I'll do it alone thing. I guess you guys aren't coming. I'm sorry, I got a conscience. I got to do this. And so that's what we did. And I said, you got a 1,400 member congregation. I said, you've told me the district doesn't bother you. You told me that your congregation is older than the Senate, and you know, you've taught them well. I go, you're the kind of guy that could lead. You're the kind of guy that doesn't have those ties. I said, fine. I said, you're a pastor, your salary's paid, lead. Well, but going back, women's ordination is the only thing. I think that's sad, but that's true.
So, that's all well and good until you realize this straw man is just standing up there by itself. And there's nothing around it. The doctrine is all gone. I'm a day late and a dollar short.
It's my opinion that we will have women doing pastoral functions, and I think in certain churches and whatever we already do, but I think it's going to be widespread. without ordination. We will either call it something else, or like lay ministers will say, oh yeah, we're still holding up the doctrine. They're just a prophetess. Or they're just standing up and giving a personal testimony. They're not really preaching. You know, but we'll put a robe on them, put them in the pulpit, and put them at the point where you're... I mean, I think that's what's going to happen. And after that happens for a while, you'll know... I mean, when my grandmother in the UCC was given a female pastor, it was uncomfortable with him for a while. After 2 years, she, you know, if I say anything to her about that, how dare I? But she, at first, she didn't like it. But you'll get used to it. It'll be okay. So you're right. I think it's just a straw man. Correct. Correct.
And contemporary worship will be one of the ways they'll vary.
Well, yeah, because see, with contemporary worship, well, it wasn't a sermon today, it was a play. And it wasn't a, I mean, you're right, all of a sudden everything gets fuzzy, doesn't it? Okay, I think I've gotten, top of page 3, 501B, 502. I did not produce for you 501B. It's about an 8-page document. Let me give you the long and short of this. 501B was passed first. This one encompassed 3 days of discussions. They brought it up here, they brought it up here. They changed it from 501 to 501A to 501B. And there was a lot of... What does it do? It sets up what's called a specific ministry pastor. I would be considered a general ministry pastor. I got full education. I got a call. I'm just normal. But there will be specific ministry pastors. We will take this guy, we will give him 5 courses, and then we will call and ordain him to a specific ministry, okay? This will be a chaplain of heating and cooling ministry, okay? So he's got a specific ministry, but we'll give him 5 courses. 3 of those will be theology, 2 of those will be heating and cooling kind of issues. So he's got the context and can relate well to this. We'll call and ordain him. Then he has to take 5 more classes in this, and then he will be officially a specific ministry pastor. He is limited. He is put under a general ministry pastor's oversight, as well as the district president, and he is not allowed to serve as a general, to serve as a pastor on boards or commissions or to vote at a thing. Kind of, you know, you, there's like some things that you can't do because we consider you're under someone else. And he can't take a call like just anywhere. He could only take a call within a specific ministry. So let's say that in Kansas City, they also have a heating and cooling ministry. You could go and take a call to be a specific ministry pastor in that, but you couldn't be a specific ministry pastor to donut ministry in Marion, Illinois. For to the cops. Donuts for cops ministry. Okay. That's what the specific ministry program is, SMPP. I will tell you that it in theory, you may not be wrong. I will question whether someone is, according to the scriptures, apt to teach. If that amount of is that enough so that you are apt to teach? I don't think so, but let's say that somehow you're able to make him apt to teach. Would that be... No. There's also a problem with why are we ordaining this guy halfway along? In other words, we're going to ask him to pledge himself to the Lutheran confessions and the scriptures, but he's not done with his coursework yet. Don't worry, just pledge, you'll do it later. We'll tell you what you pledged to. I mean, that's the problem with this, okay? But they keep telling us, no, they'll have enough training. They'll be okay. So, again, even if... I give the benefit of the doubt. They are apt to teach, and let's say that they do give them enough so that they can actually take their vows honestly. The end result is this says nothing about lay ministers. Let me make one more thing. One other thing. I know that there are... The district presidents will not allow you to get rid of lay ministry because they have their own house of studies. They train lay ministers. They do it in their thing. They won't allow this. That's why we had the other resolution that said let us study it a little bit more or whatever. This one that does this specific ministry program, the liberals love it. The conservatives say, well, this is better than lay ministers, and this is a step towards the lay ministers going away, and this is better than nothing. And I keep saying, You're connecting these two dots. This just created another position. This is lay ministers. Nothing about this says that lay ministers are going away. Nothing says they're going into this plan. Nothing said that lay ministry was wrong. In fact, what did we say? It's fine and good and right. And we're going to keep doing it. We're going to study it and see if we want to do it some more and if we still need it. And so there were conservatives that voted for this, and they will tell you it's better than, and it's helping, and it's a start. And I think someone like President Miller would come in here and say, well, I did get that passed. And I think you need to say, what does that have to do with lay ministers? It has absolutely nothing.
Just a number of questions. One is there a definition of who does the instructing? And is the instructing done by the seminaries alone, or by can districts do the instructing through whatever they want to do?
Similar to that other overture, with this one, President Kieschnick had the chairman of the committee and both seminary presidents or representatives from the seminaries to stand up and say, we support this, this is a good thing. Why did they support it? Because unlike the lay ministry program, the seminary does do the training or oversees it. And so the seminary looked at this and said, this is a way in which we can get our hands back on this power kind of thing. We can be in control in somewhat. And so this is something that the seminary said we are going to do. Now, they'll do it by distance learning and by whatever, but that's my understanding. Is that yours?
I wasn't sure on that. That's why
I'm pretty sure that is the case.
Secondly, is there a requirement as to what's the distance that can be made between the specific minister and the general pastor who's overseeing him? I mean, could he be like 50 miles away and really have no oversight whatsoever?
Absolutely. What I see is this being none, in practicality, is similar to a lay minister in that the district president can simply get 20 specific ministry people, throw them out into his district. You know, the general ministry pastor that's overseeing him is 100 miles away. No distinction, no, it's not lined out. And when the delegates would ask questions like that, they would say, well, we're still putting this together. We don't have all of the everything. And so we pretty well was trust us on it. But at this point, there's nothing like that. There's no limitations. I mean, you could supervise a guy in Hawaii. I'll pass around curriculum. You've got a four-year curriculum for a general ministry pastor. They do have a program called DELTO that they are working on that has been in place for a while called Distance Education. I don't know what the other thing is. Leading Towards Ordination. 30 courses, 30 courses are required in which they do this distance education over the internet. They send a professor out. The idea was Hispanic ministry or something like that, and they couldn't move their family up, and so they'll send a professor out who would speak the language and could do it and all. This is presently going on. It was said again and again, we're not trying to do anything different. We're simply doing what DELTO does in a different way. And so then this is SMPP. DELTO, 30 courses and ordination at the end. SMPP, 5 courses before, ordination in the middle, 5 courses at the end.
Oh, yeah.
It's just the same program.
Who would do DELTO?
Right. That's what I was thinking.
No. Exactly. And so if someone said, at least practically speaking, this replaces DELTO. DELTO just went away. So, all right, so they're not. But if you were a lay minister, why would you want to do this? I can go to the district course, get this thing done, go out and do Word and Sacrament, and I got no problem. Anyway, you can pass that around. It kind of shows the distinction.
When they talk about specific ministry, they mean like to Hispanics or blacks or to youth? Is that what they're talking about?
It could. I made a joke over
right.
here, but when in the specific ministry pastoral program, there are things like church planter, they called it. And when they talk about it, we would assume it was like specific nationality or prison campus ministry. It doesn't say, but I'm guessing that this is more like, you know, a specific ministry to the youth. I mean, I bet this, there are no categories lined out ahead of time. So could it be donut ministry to the cops? I think it could. I really do.
Could it just as easily end up being specific ministry
congregations that have nobody else? I mean, that's,
yes.
That's where it looks like it's kind of headed.
But then again, why didn't, you know, what's the need for that? We've already got the lay ministry thing.
And lay ministers usually are... Usually they have another job, and that's the exact point. Why do that? Why not take a, and I don't mean a bad sense, why not take a charismatic individual who's read the Bible pretty well in your own congregation and just send him up to the district an hour away for a couple times and make him your lay minister? So...
Just a little humorous aside, the original name of that was Special Associate Pastor.
Zap. Interesting. Last page, page 4 of this, has a number 6 by several of them. This is our ecclesiastical supervision. What is it? Ecclesiastical. Yeah. Ecclesiastical supervision and the dispute resolution process. We objected to, as I mentioned, some of the CCM overtures or opinions stating that ecclesiastical supervisor could approve something and then you wouldn't be held responsible. You know, these kind of things that were listed in the dispute resolution process and about this. There's not one overture in particular that deals with this, but it was. I will cite one, and I will show it to you, and I think that's enough. But there was a lot that dealt with this. Some of these I put a 6 by and marked through it because they debated it, and then they just let it drop because it was so confrontational that they weren't going to deal with it. For example, 708A at the top there, a bylaw to have removal of individual members from the board or commission. Membership. What they wanted to do was, and they had a list of things, like duty of loyalty, insubordination, conduct unbecoming of a Christian. If a member of the board of directors did something that was one of these things, then the board of directors themselves as a group could make a vote whether they had done that, and they could remove that member from the board of directors. So guess what? Over the last 3 years, if you happen to be someone who helped to file a lawsuit, they could... kick you out, remove you, you know, say, well, you were not being loyal to the Senate, duty of loyalty. I mean, this insubordination? Whoa! You know, you don't support contemporary worship? You're insubordination. This is what the Senate has said. This brought up a lot of ire, okay, and a lot of discussion. But one of the things that was most interesting is someone got up and said, this contradicts Missouri law. We are incorporated in Missouri for a nonprofit organization. Those who are members of the board of directors, according to Missouri law, have to be elected, and if they are removed, they have to be removed from the same group that elected them. And so, well, let's ask the, and so they brought a gal, Cheryl Strand, who happens to be one of the lawyers for the Senate. She came forward. She gave this 5-minute speech in lawyerese in which she said, well, this overture for you to pass, it's not illegal for you to pass this overture. Now, it may not be effective, but it's not illegal. And she went on, and that, and I mean, she spent 5 minutes kind of saying this. When it all got done, everyone kind of went, oh, well, it's not illegal. You know, I mean, that's what this guy said, it was illegal, and she said it's not. Christian Preuss, who is a lawyer, gets up to the mic and said, I don't think the delegates understood what she said. He said, you ask Senate's lawyer right there, ask him what he about this, whether this contradicts with Missouri law. The other lawyer comes up to the mic and says, according to the Missouri law, you know, you can only be removed by this. He said, right, it's not illegal to pass this, but if you pass this and then you remove someone, someone is going to sue your socks off and you're going to be landed in jail because you can't do this. When she said ineffective, this just opens the Senate up to lawsuits. The entire convention went, oh. And everybody kind of looked over at the other lawyer, looked at Kieschnick, you know. This was like one of two times during the whole convention where everybody kind of went, huh, is somebody behind that curtain? You know? And at that point, the committee chairperson goes, that's the first time we've ever heard that. And from that point on, they declined it. They didn't even vote. They just kind of, let's go on to the next overture, and it never came back. Okay? That's one of those
that... Who was the lawyer that got up and made that statement? Who was that?
Christian Preuss. I don't know the guy's the other lawyer's name for Senate.
No,
Cheryl Strand. Cheryl Strand is the one that gave the ambiguous one, but there was a, I don't know, it was a man. I don't know who it was. But it's just use it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was pretty sad. Okay. The last thing, and this will kind of wrap up, and then we can talk about whatever kind of things you want. I know some of you watched it. We talked about some of the things earlier, but you might want to bring it up on behalf of others. The last thing, and especially if some of you need to leave, you can at least have heard it. If you go down to Resolution 805A, the CTCR document encouraging public rebuke of public sin, this is the one that had some... problems about where we said you're forcing someone to do a face-to-face meeting when it's a public sin. If it's a public sin, you can speak about it and warn people. And this is one where I would say the Senate did back off on it and said, okay, we will admit that a face-to-face is not required for public sin. And we want that reflected in the bylaws. And I would say they actually took a step back and actually responded. They did go on in the same resolution to say, but we're still going to require it for all of Senate's procedures. Okay, so you know, I guess you're not scripturally wrong, but they did mention. The one thing, though, that was 810, this is the one where I would say, is there one overture that would deal with our 6 point? Yeah. To refer for theological study, CCM opinions, and there it lists those three. Those are three that we complained about. Those are the ones that I said approve your ecclesiastical supervisor and a couple other things that go along with this, and we said these are wrong, right? They approved these after Behnke's deal in order to get him off. The 2004 convention passed a resolution in which these overtures, these opinions are listed in it, and the board of directors had declared them null and void. This resolution said, no, these are fine. We can keep them. The 2007 convention now has this thing to study these. Now, 810 said we ought to study these. If you will go to the third to last page, page 151, and what do they ask? Resolution 810, if you go down to the last resolve, we're going to take these opinions, which were already rendered, and we're going to see as to how the theological issues are addressed under the most recent changes and policies, and we're going to study it. So they didn't rescind it. They just said, let's study it. If you turn the page, Charlie Henriksen, probably remember the name, he's preached here before we went into a state of confession where I was gone, he got up and said, and this is the last day of the convention, he got up and said and complained profusely, you are not allowing real debate to happen. You keep putting forward these overtures that don't deal with the real thing. We need to deal with the real thing. These three overtures, and he went through, and it's fabulous if you happen to read this, in which he says, down at line 31, whereas seven districts, Minnesota South, South Dakota, Central Illinois, Montana, Nebraska, Missouri, Southern Illinois, nine congregations, two circuit forums, one pastor's conference, have submitted overtures in the convention workbook which call for overruling of the CC opinions on ecclesiastical supervision. And he went on to complain, you've not even given us a chance to vote this up or down. At least let us discuss it. You know, you keep making us study it. You keep pushing it off. In 2004, we never dealt with it. Let's deal with it. Let's put it on the floor. And I'm having to do this on the last day of the convention. There were 1,200 delegates. At this point, there's only 700 that are still around to even debate it. But and so he proposed this substitute resolution and talked about it. It failed with... I can't remember. I guess I didn't put it on here. I don't know what the substitute failed with, but it failed to be considered as a substitute, and when the original came up, it passed at 75.9%. Once again, it was brought up and said, this is the concern. We won't deal with it. President Kishner asked the CCM guy, come on up, CCM, tell us what they... And he says, well, that's not... Absolutely, that's not true. At 2004, we did deal with that. It was in the middle of an overture, and it was done. Okay. We had 6 points. I walked through kind of all 6 points. At each and every point...